Ukraine says its forces are making advances near the eastern city of Bakhmut.
So it has certain strategic meaning because basically it prevents other cities such as Slovyansk and Kramatorsk and Konstantinivka in the Donetsk region to be reached.
Plus, we look at the closening military ties between Russia and Iran.
And the reason they're doing that is just in case any of the pipelines get cut off from Iran to Russia, that Russia still has the capacity to make those Iranian drones.
And examine the pressure Turkey is facing ahead of next week's NATO summit. Today is Friday, July 7th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Saturday marks 500 days since Russia invaded Ukraine on February 24th of 2022, and peace talks are still a long way off as both sides look to improve their hand, with Ukrainians trying to recapture as much territory as they can, and Russia intent on holding it. While the fighting has fallen largely into a stalemate, there's been no significant movement in the battle lines for months, the war continues to take a heavy toll on the lives and livelihoods of hundreds of thousands of people, and fears of a nuclear disaster have increased, particularly this week, after Ukraine and Russia accused each other of planning to attack one of the world's largest atomic power plants. However, Ukrainian forces have advanced by more than a kilometer against Russian troops near the eastern city of Bakhmut. Joining us from Kyiv is Anna Chernikova with additional details.
I can say that Bakhmut, it's both symbolic, but also it has certain strategic meaning because basically it prevents other cities such as Slovyansk and Kramatorsk and Konstantinivka in the Donetsk region to be reached by Russian forces with artillery. So basically for Ukrainian forces, it's important to make sure that they all the surroundings of Bakhmut or even actually push Russians away from Bakhmut because this creates more safe conditions for these other cities and for this direction in general. And of course, as President Zelensky mentioned a lot of times already, and also Ukrainian military officials, that every centimeter of Ukrainian land is strategic for Ukraine.
And Anna, as we head into the weekend, as well as look forward to next week's NATO summit, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has been making the rounds again around neighboring European countries, visiting Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, Slovakia. What can you tell us about what he is hoping to achieve in these recent trips?
This is another trip, foreign trip by President Zelensky. It was not announced, of course. It was not, no hints were given publicly due to security reasons. And those countries that will also be present at NATO summit next week. And of course, in all those countries, the main topic for discussion and for negotiation is definitely security and defense and defense possibilities for Ukraine and security of the region in general and Ukraine in particular. Also, President Zelensky discusses a NATO question with the leaders of this country. And this might not be the last country he's visiting. So here inside of Ukraine, there are talks about his possible visit of some other countries before a NATO summit. So we will see.
Anna Chernikova reports for us from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
The Biden administration is signaling it will be sending cluster munitions to Ukraine to help in its war against Russia. It's a move that will likely anger human rights groups. The announcement may come on Friday, but after our recording deadline. The controversial weapons are fired from a cannon and release dozens of bomblets across a wide area. They can cause harm long after the fighting has ended. Cluster munitions have been banned in 123 countries because of the risk they pose to civilians, but the United States, Ukraine, and Russia have not banned them. The European Union is also making strides to increase munitions production for itself to deliver to Ukraine. From the Associated Press, Charles de Ledesma has that part of our coverage.
The EU's taken a major step in approving plans to boost its production of ammunition and missiles within the 27-nation bloc, aimed at both defending itself and quickly helping Ukraine in trying to push back the invasion by Russia. The EU presidency has announced that the member states and the EU parliament reached a deal to urgently mobilize around $500 million from its budget for the act in support of ammunition production deal. The deal follows up the March decision by EU leaders to boost urgently needed ammunition deliveries to Ukraine. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Turkey is facing mounting pressure from its NATO allies to lift its opposition to Sweden's membership bid. But Ankara says it will not change its position until its demands are met. And analysts say the impasse will probably have to be solved next week at the NATO summit in Lithuania. Dorian Jones is up next.
Ahead of the NATO summit, U.S. President Joe Biden reaffirmed to Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson his support for Sweden's membership bid to join the military alliance.
The United States fully supports Sweden's membership in NATO.
NATO member Turkey is facing growing pressure to lift its opposition to Sweden's bid to join the alliance. Ankara is demanding that Stockholm crack down on activities of the Kurdish separatist group, the PKK, which is waging an insurgency against Turkey and is designated a terrorist organization by the United States and the European Union. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan acknowledged Stockholm has taken steps, but says they're not enough. Swedish authorities did not intervene in the recent public burning of a Koran, and analysts say that further eroded Ankara's trust in Stockholm. Soli Özel teaches international relations at Istanbul's Kadahas University.
It is interpreted as a general insensitivity and therefore also interpreted as that Swedes will pretend to be doing the right things until they get what they want, which is, of course, NATO membership, and then things will revert back to what they were. I think that's the insinuation.
Swedish and Turkish diplomats met Thursday with NATO representatives to resolve the impasse. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said progress was made, but no breakthrough. Analysts say Ankara is also looking for concessions from Washington, including a long-awaited sale of military jets. Asla Aydin-Tashbash of the Brookings Institution in Washington.
It may or may not be cleared on the Vilnius summit, but my sense is that the ask has just gone up. But not too much, but by a little bit. It's always been the case that President Erdogan would want the Biden administration to step in and offer some concessions in return for Turkey ratifying Sweden's NATO entry.
Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, a close ally of Erdogan, also has yet to back Sweden's bid and has indicated he would follow Turkey's stance on NATO enlargement. Analysts note that Erdogan likes to broker deals face-to-face with fellow world leaders. They predict any deal on Sweden's membership may only be made at next week's NATO summit, when all sides have a chance to meet face-to-face. Erdogan has long coveted an invitation from Biden to Washington. Analysts say that is among the possibilities at the NATO summit. For Sweden, it's a nervous wait. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
Iran formally joined the Shanghai Cooperation this week as a security grouping founded by Russia and China to counter Western alliances from East Asia to the Indian Ocean. In June, the Biden administration said that ties between Moscow and Tehran were deepening as Russia made plans to produce Iranian drones within its borders. For analysis on these deepening ties between Russia and Iran, as well as the impact for the region, I spoke with Craig Albert, professor of political science and the graduate director of the Master of Arts in Intelligence and Security Studies at Augusta University in Georgia. Taking a look at what the White House recently released about its assertion that Moscow and Tehran are deepening ties, regarding this military partnership, it says in terms of collaboration and drone production within the Russian Federation, you know, what do you see as the significance of that? I mean, is it just a manufacturing plant, or does it really truly signal something more than just a fabrication facility?
Well, it shows that the military alliance is, you know, full steam ahead, that they're certainly defense partners, if not a, you know, a formal treaty defense alliance yet. And the reason they're doing that is just in case any of the pipelines get cut off from Iran to Russia, that Russia still has the capacity to make those Iranian drones to use in the war with Ukraine. So that's the main point, is that the supply line won't be able to be hindered by anything Ukraine does by blocking off portions or any other adversary of Russia or Iran. So that's the first point. The second point is that it does set up the possibility for deepening and furthering of infrastructure ties and economic ties between the two countries. And I think that might be a more, what are we going to see in the future between the two in that line? And this shows us that they might have an idea of having closer ties both economically and with the infrastructure interests as well.
You know, speaking of those supply line concerns, since Russia invaded Ukraine well over a year ago, there have been all these international sanctions that have really put a hamper on what Russia can import. You mentioned possibly having these fabrication facilities inside the Russian Federation would allow it to continue to produce these drones if Ukraine were to somehow cut the supply. But given that the sanctions that are already in place, you know, what challenges do you see in terms of even Russia being able to manufacture these, given the limitations on trade with Russia after the war began?
Yeah, that's a great question. The U.S. has, let's not just consider Russia, but also Iran, right? Because the U.S. and U.S. corporations and worldwide corporations don't want to do anything that lands them on the hot seat with the U.S. for giving any type of sponsorship, material, or economics that goes against any of the U.S.'s sanctions against Iran or Russia. So it's a complicated matter with a manufacturing plant being in Russia. What companies are going to be a part of this, and not just the hardware for building these Iranian drones, but also the software needed to protect the plant from cyber attacks, for instance, which is something Russia's going to definitely need to invest in, because you can imagine that Ukraine's going to go right after that to try to shut it down. And NATO allies might assist Ukraine in doing that. So there's all types of second and third order effects of what companies are willing to invest in it. Is anybody willing to invest outside of Russia and Iran? And the only countries I can think of that might be able to or want to are the typical rogue states or states that are friendly to Russia. And I'm thinking here of North Korea, maybe Venezuela, China, which has been kind of ambiguous on its support of Russia for the war in Ukraine, but it might be able to provide the necessary material to go into Russia for this manufacturing plant, and other types of war material plants that might be on the horizon, thinking of hypersonic missile manufacturing. So we know that Iran just developed its own hypersonic missile, and it's not too far-fetched to think that they want to build those in Russia to supplement Russia's hypersonic capabilities as well. So any type of company that partakes in this is liable to be sanctioned by the United States and NATO, if not EU itself as well. So that's something that has to be considered. So it's going to be complicated to see how likely it is that it's going to work out. But I would guess, based on the satellite images that have been, you know, publicly released, that the plant is pretty much ready to go. They're just finishing the industrial line capacity on the inside, which means, I assume, that most of the material is already there, or Russia can process this itself, and Iran just gave them the blueprints for the plant and how to make the drones. So I think everything is probably in place for them to go live with that and be able to produce up to 6,000 drones per year.
You know, you mentioned that the facility is perhaps almost ready to go online and produce this large number of drones per year, which Russia really has been using to, you know, carry out a number of airstrikes within Ukraine, especially in recent months. But there also have been some reports of attacks either by pro-Ukrainian forces in Russia carrying out attacks on Russian soil, and allegations that Ukrainian forces have carried out attacks within the Russian Federation, not using U.S. equipment, but other equipment that they have. When these plants go online and start producing material that Russia may use against Ukraine, what kind of security concerns does that bring up for the Russian Federation now that they have a new plant online that apparently appears to be producing weapons specifically to target Ukrainians in Ukraine?
Yeah, another great question. That's why Russia is building this particular plant in the far east of Russia. So it's far away from any potential Ukrainian saboteurs. Of course, you do have to worry about the Russian militias who are anti-Putin, but that movement is less of a worry in the far east of Russia than it is the closer you get to the European landmass itself. So I think that's probably what went into the calculation of moving that plant or creating that plant in the far east. What you do have to worry about is, A, as we've already mentioned a little bit, is the cybersecurity concerns, because for sure, I assume even now, if that plant is online at all, it is already being, you know, gauged and seeing what vulnerabilities it has to come under some type of cyber attack. And it would probably be a large scale attack to do perhaps physical infrastructure damage to the plant itself, taking it offline completely. Something like that happened in Nantent, for the Iranian nuclear reactors, that, you know, actual physical infrastructure damage was done. Look for that to happen at this plant. So that's the first security concern. The second is the transportation of those drones to the front for Ukraine. So you can look certainly for saboteurs, either Russian militia themselves that are anti-Putin, something that we've seen in the you know, borderlands between Russia and Ukraine already happening, where you have Russian citizens engaging in uprising against some of the regional districts and oblasts of Russia, or we don't know if this is already occurring. Ukraine say it's not, but one suspects it actually is, where you have Ukrainian special operations forces infiltrating Russia itself. That's my personal opinion of how some of these drone attacks are happening, is that it's Russian militants working in collusion with Ukrainian special forces. So you can look for them to try to attack the supply routes. Russia underreports this a lot, of its railways coming under attack inside Russia, of some of its pipelines coming under attack, its electrical grids coming under attack, physical attacks by drones, by saboteurs throughout the country, not just on the front with Ukraine. So that's already occurring, and you can expect to see an increase in that type of operation once this plant is close to going live, or once it is fully operational and functional. But I think you can look for them to try to prevent them, Ukraine trying to prevent it from becoming fully online.
You know, later on this year, October, the JCPOA, the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, is going to sunset some of the clauses in there. And I wanted to get your take on, with the Biden administration releasing new advisories on trade with Iran, what kind of impact you see that may have on international trade with Iran and its, you know, apparent burgeoning partnership with Russia.
I mean, this is a very serious threat. How much material does Iran already supply to Russia is unknowable. We know that they're shipping material. We see that they're shipping things into Russia. We can't always be sure what's being shipped. And I'm not quite sure that any agreement or any cessation of the Iran nuclear deal is going to prevent anything from going from Iran to Russia. Iran is, you know, doesn't always play well according to international rules, just like Russia doesn't always play well to international rules. So I'm not sure what type of effect a negotiated settlement of the Iran deal elapsing, or a renegotiated protocol that President Biden wants to happen, that the supreme leader of Iran says he's not against, you know, kind of supplementing that deal in order to get some more economic sanctions lifted against Iran. I'm just not sure how much we can trust that process with Iran overall. I mean, they have been increasing their production of nuclear material. They're clearly already delivering drones to Russia. So Iran seems to be, you know, engaged with increasing its relationship with Russia, not necessarily for, you know, bringing down Ukraine, but perhaps necessarily bringing down the unipolar world it might view as America leading. And Russia is always saying that it wants a multipolar world, and it views that the United States is trying to maintain, you know, an international hegemony of, you know, a one single dominant actor. Iran obviously would be in cahoots with Russia, and, you know, at least the last year has shown that they'd be in cahoots with Russia in trying to bring down the U.S. So it's a complicated situation where we're not sure, and the U.S. wasn't sure if the Iran nuclear deal would work in the first place. And so renegotiating it, or if things sunset and they're allowed more capabilities to export material for the war, it's just complicated, and we don't know. What we don't know, because we don't know what Iran is actually doing, how closely they're following rules, or, you know, what chances they'll increase their productivity in any event. I hope that makes sense. It's a complicated question because of just how rogue Iran is when it comes to these types of things.
You know, and speaking of complications, China is another actor who hasn't come out and really condemned Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and, you know, President Xi Jinping and President Putin have fostered closer ties. So what role do you kind of see as a possible, even expanded complication of the Tehran-Moscow relationship when you factor in Beijing's place on the world stage?
This is what, you know, keeps me up at night, Steve, this burgeoning alliance between Iran, China, and Russia, where if they really formed a legitimate defense pact, could bring the world back into a Cold War era-like chess game, where you have those three powers and their allies. So you would have to, again, throw states like Venezuela, Cuba, North Korea, especially, in against the United States and NATO. And so those three states forming something together is something that the entire world needs to be concerned about. Beijing right now is playing it very close to the chest, what they want. They don't want a dominant Russia in their hemisphere either, because China wants to be the dominant actor. So it's still too early to tell what type of defense alliance they're likely to form with Russia, which is why they're not fully supplying Russia. We know that they're supplying Russia in some components to help facilitate Russia's war against Ukraine, but they're certainly not doing it to the effect that they could do it. And so the reasoning behind that is because they don't want to see a dominant Russia either. They want to see Russia weaken so that China is the main actor in Asia, in that hemisphere completely. But to the extent that China also wants to see the United States descend from unipole status, and, you know, academics and policymakers are divided on whether or not the United States is the global hegemon, I tend to side on the idea that the United States, as far as superpower goes, is the most powerful superpower. So we can call it a hegemon for theoretical or hypothetical purposes anyways. That China is a revisionist state actor. It wants to see the United States decrease in power. And therefore, when you play balance of power politics, China certainly might decide to side fully with Russia in an attempt to bring down the United States, even if that complicates China's rise to supremacy in its own hemisphere.
Craig Albert is a professor of political science, as well as the graduate director of the Master of Arts in Intelligence and Security Studies at Augusta University in Georgia. Craig, thank you very much for your insight.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for us this week. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage, not only on Ukraine, but on news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media platforms. Just be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, ba 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 zip. DC.